the thing, the whole evolution narrative is the most, it's just so hilarious because the evolution narrative has to be, ends up being teleological. I mean, they can't avoid it. Every time they try to make it non-teleological, they fail. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And so it always ends up having to be teleological. And so then it becomes non-scientific immediately. It just becomes a kind of a mythological pattern. And it's like, well, if it's just mythological story, my mythological story is much better. Like the creation narrative in Genesis accounts way in a better manner for the ontological hierarchy of your experience of the world than the way that that evolution talks about reality. And you can see, like, I mean, you know, when I talked about Weinstein, it's always the same issue. And you see the same with all the evolutionary theorists. They're basically saying what evolution really wants you to do is to basically kill and compete and take and and just get your seed out there, get your genes to the next generation. But of course we shouldn't do that.
Right.
It's like, okay, well, where do you get the we shouldn't do that from?
Yeah.
Right. That's actually what interests me, because that's a lot closer to what I care about. And then maybe you can find that in the Genesis story, but you can't find it anywhere else in your little pattern, like in your little worldview.
This is Jonathan Peugeot. Welcome to the symbolic world.
So I have a couple of special guests with me today on Grail Country. I have Michael Martin, who's kind of a regular and a friend of the channel. Dr. Michael Martin, you can find on his own podcast these days, Regeneration Podcasts, where he has very interesting guests. And a guest who will need no introduction for most of my audience, Jonathan Peugeot of the Symbolic World.
That's great. It's great to finally meet both of you in person. Yeah. I've had contact with Michael for a long time.
Really, at least 10 years, I bet.
Exactly. Yeah. I sent in a piece of art for his magazine once, and we met through a common friend. And so it's great to see you in person.
Yeah, it is nice.
Well, that's great to learn.
I feel
about
like I've known
connection.
You for a long time, you know?
Yeah, that's what it feels like too, but we've never actually spoken. So
Yeah, that's very interesting because like when I first started reading Michael's books, it's like, that's immediately, it's like, oh, I need to have him talk to Peugeot at some point, somehow. That's got to happen. It's like, they've got to talk. So here we are. So I might do more listening than talking today, because I'm excited to hear the two of you talk. I just kind of dive in, like one thing that we can, like kind of the thing we're going to talk about today is kind of like Christian esotericism, mysticism, that kind of thing. And we've been doing this series on Tolberg's Meditation of the Tarot, on the Tarot, on Grail Country. Michael has taught the book and read it several times, and he's been a guest on some of our episodes, and you've started reading it recently too. So I thought we could just like maybe dive into that and tell us about what your impressions have been of the book so far.
I think it's wonderful. There are obviously a few caveats. I was really surprised about the reincarnation bit. I was like, really? That's a little surprising. And I know where he gets it. I mean, obviously he's a Kabbalist, so he gets it from the whole cycle of souls thing. That's probably where, because a lot of his stuff seems to refer to Kabbalah. So, but besides that, I think his cosmic vision is very much aligned with mine, and the way that he understands what he calls vertical causality. He's also adding some vocabulary for me that I'll be able to use, I think, in the future, because it's definitely connected directly to, you know, and I think the richness of the book is also that, I mean, this is what we'll get into later, probably in our discussion, even with you, Michael, is that I think one of the reasons why I've bifurcated from kind of Christian esotericism and kind of stepped back from it is that I felt like the way that it was presenting itself to me, especially in the recent, let's say in the last, I mean, I guess more like at least 100 years, has been almost as a challenge to Christianity, and has been presented almost as something which was subversive to Christianity. And I think that when reading Tom Bird's book, I think that he's really trying to reconcile, you know, the esoteric traditions in the West with, you know, real Christianity. And so I was really appreciative of that.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it seems like what he's doing is almost a plea with esotericists to cooperate with the church. It's kind of the tone of like a lot of the book.
Definitely. I mean, I've read about maybe a third of the book, so I'm nowhere near from done, but for sure, everything I'm seeing, like I said, except for the weird reincarnation thing, everything else I feel is I think that someone would read, if someone read that book and then watch my videos, they would immediately understand what I'm talking about. and probably vice versa. Like if people watch my videos and then read that book, they would immediately understand. So that's great.
Yeah. I think what I think he's doing, and it resonates with a lot of people, is there's a kind of traditionalism to him. It's a kind of not only appreciation, but devotion to traditional sacramental forms of Christianity. I mean, he's a Russian writing in French about Western esotericism. And it's very different. You know, I don't know, maybe I don't know enough about it, but from what I know, especially the East and especially in Russia, the esoteric traditions, if you want to call them that, there were actually borrowed from the West.
Yeah,
from Jacob Burma and even the Philadelphian Society and people like that. And then start with the Protestants, moved to the Russians, came back, at least part of it, came back to the West. But in the West, I mean, you know, part of what I think Tomberg's doing, a lot of what he draws on is not what I would even call like kind of a traditional, kind of hesitate to use the word, Christian hermeticism, the word he uses.
Yeah,
because his Christian hermeticism is grounded more in the 19th century, and when he quotes all these authors like Eliphas Levi and Papel.
Yeah, most of his sources seem to be like late, yeah, like 19th and early 20th century. He has Peladon
which are all, I mean, they're all interesting. Peladon in particular is kind of fascinating to me. But Tomber, so my doctorate is in 16th and 17th century English. Or English literature, religious literature, when hermeticism was hermeticism. So it's a very different, it's very different, you know, that strain of hermeticism. So when people talk about Rosicrucianism or hermeticism and they think it's like being a Freemason, I'm like, well, no, that's those kind of
ceremonial
guys. Well, the thing is, what happened is after the 17th century, when there was a kind of a revival of that stuff and it was connected to Masonry in the 18th century, 19th century, they kind of just borrowed the vernacular and appropriated it. And it really doesn't have a lot to do with what this kind of, because if you look at like traditional figures from the Hermetic period in 17th century England, like Robert Flood and Thomas and Henry Vaughan and Jacob Burm, they were, if we would have talked to them in right now, they would have described themselves as kind of traditional Christians.
Yeah.
What they were rejecting was the scientific revolution and its base materialism, and which, if you can do science without the realm of the spirit, they thought that was crazy, right? And so they were kind of traditionalists. They were kind of.
You're right. There's a way in which it seemed like the Freemasons, they seem to have. They basically just want to aggregate all the esotericism. They seemed, at least at some moment, maybe not so much now, but at least in the 19th century, they seemed to want to just kind of pull everything into mm-hmm. their sphere. And so started using all this imagery from the different esoteric traditions. And so that's why I think today people also conflate it all together. Mm-hmm, and because exactly. of also the strangeness of the Luciferian hoax that happened with the Masons, that all got weirdly kind of brought into modern occultism and then mm-hmm. taken up by the Satanists, basically using the Tech Seals hoax as a template for their Satanism. It's just so, all of it just so weird that,
yeah,
that's also one of the reasons why I kind of tend to stay away.
Yeah, no kidding. I would too. Yeah.
Stuff, because it just like, it's also hard for people to be able to differentiate. And I often feel like I don't have to, like, I don't need it. You know, I feel like I have in St. Gregory of Nyssa and in St. Maximus and in, you know, a good cosmic understanding of the liturgy. It's like, I have everything I need. And if I'm going to pull from other sources, I can do it once in a while, but I tend not to do it too much, because if I do, then people get confused. That's my feeling, at least.
I understand. Mm-hmm. You ever read the book Foucault's Pendulum?
Yeah.
That's a hilarious book.
Yeah, it's hilarious. I really enjoyed it. I thought I read it, the whole thing, as a giant, like, kind of joke on it.
It is. It is. It's set up. It's like a 400 page setup to a joke, you know, because what he does, because all the so-called occultists, you know, they get talked into thinking they're members of an occult group they didn't know existed, but they're sure they're initiates into it.
And yeah, he basically invents an esoteric society. And then it's basically saying, like, because it's the idea of the secret is what rules a lot of these players, then if we create another secret, it's almost like creating a body it's like a little vacuum for which people to kind of step into. Right. I mean, you have people today, all these people saying they're Rosicrucians. Like, you've got these Rosicrucian churches in Africa. There was a lot of them.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Called Rosicrucian churches. And you have all these. And all these people who think they're Templars, and the same with the Freemasons who think they're Templars and stuff. A lot of it, I feel, is so fantastical that I tend to.
No, you're right. I mean, they're just appropriating ideas. Like, I don't think there's any substance there.
Yeah. See, Guénon, like René Guénon had, I don't know how serious it was, but with Papus, they had the idea of creating a kind of Christian esoteric thing using Freemasonry, the Martinism. Yeah. I think it still exists today. There are still Martinists today.
Arthur Edward Waite was another one.
Okay. I mean,
And there's some of those people in the occult revival of the late 19th and early 20th century. I mean, some of them, not everybody, but some of them tried to Christianize it or tried to.
Yeah, Waite was a member of the Golden Dawn at the same time as Charles Williams.
Yeah, but they both bailed on it, right? And mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's actually because I was puzzling over this whole phenomenon in anticipation of our talk and thinking about, you know, now I'm technically an Eastern Rite Catholic and Jonathan is Orthodox, so it's pretty much the same thing. But there's no tradition like that, as far as I know, in those realms. I mean, they certainly picked the Russians, for instance, would pick up on Freemasonry and all that stuff after the fact. But there's no there's no homegrown version, right?
But I think that the reason why we don't see a homegrown version is that we don't see what we could call we don't see the split. Because one of the problems is that there's a problem with high theory in the world of esotericism, which is that I think that when people start to create explicit systems and try to create things that are very, very that are very explicit systems of causality and higher beings and all this mm-hmm. stuff. I think that that's one of the issues that happens in Western esotericism. There's almost like a split between popular religion that becomes more sentimental and more morality based. And mm-hmm. then you have this thing that splits out and becomes very high-minded and intellectual and esoteric.
Very intellectual, yeah.
But I can find everything in the Icon of the Last Judgment that you could find in any esoteric system that you could develop, you know, in the layout of a church and the way that it's all set up, it's all there, but it's not necessarily theorized, right. Is what the way that I would say it. And I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it does. But where I was heading, pardon me, is so I'm preparing for, I have to get this lecture in September on Pavel Florensky.
Yeah.
The Russian sociologist, priest and martyr. And so I was reading some of his earlier articles. He was only in his early 20s. And a phrase that comes up at least twice, maybe more in those articles, is the salt has lost its savor. And he was concerned, and I think he was already ordained by this point. He was concerned that the experience of Christianity in Russia at the time, that for a lot of people, the salt had lost its savor. There was no flavor to it. And I think, and looking around now, and I can imagine what drew Tom Berg, for instance, I mean, because he grew up in Russia, or drew people like Arthur Edward Waite or whoever it happens to be toward that stuff is, I think,
Blavatsky, there is some, for goodness sake.
Well, Blavatsky, she's kind of, yeah, she's Russian too. But she's,
yeah.
What's with
that's
the
why I mentioned her.
Yeah. But my point is that, and in fact, if you read the notes of Bulgakov and Florensky and Florensky's book, The Pillar and the what's it called?
Yeah. Isn't it Pillar and Ground of Truth or something?
Yes. The Pillar and Ground of Truth.
Yeah.
Is that they were reading a lot of people like Rudolf Steiner and Leadbeater. I don't know if they were quote Blavatsky, but they do those other people and John Portage and Jakob Burma. So they were definitely aware of that stuff. And I think the reason being, and let's hear what you guys think about this, is that like we see right now, with a lot of kids who grow up, or even adults who grew up in a Christian tradition. And somehow the salt loses its savor for them. And then they, whether they're drawn to Buddhism or something very exotic, or I see a lot of kids being drawn toward neo-paganism, for instance. Yeah. And I'm wondering if this is the same kind of thing that Florensky was seeing in 1903, and that maybe was impacting those people in the occult revival of the 19th century.
That's a good theory. I think it's an interesting theory. And I think it also, you could say something like it connects to my own experience, which is that for me, I never stopped being a Christian. I always really stayed a Christian, but let's say there was a detour and then a return where it's like I was reading more exotic things and stranger things. And then I was able to then look back at, you know, traditional Christianity and find in it, you know, the fullness that I had been missing. But mm-hmm. when I did, though, I also left to the side a lot of the weird stuff that I might have been interested, because I felt like there was something about it which was, like I said, there's something about it that was deincarnational, like that was like too high. And so it tended to suck the world towards a kind of
it's a head trip.
Yeah,
it's
exactly. A head
trip. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's also because a lot of people I met, they would tend to use esoteric ideas to relativize existence constantly, to constantly relativize forms. And yep. So they're constantly criticizing any form and everything as if, you know, it's all about this high, and it's like Ein Sof, as if it's like Ein Sof will destroy the world. It's not supposed to be in the world. And so you have to be careful with, even with non-dualists, you see it all the time. When non-dualists are out of control, they tend to want to, they have this like weird pulsion inside them to destroy the world and to kind of relativize everything to the point that it actually. And so I think that's why I tend to come back. And I think incarnational thinking, and that's why, like, to a certain extent, Hermeticism has something I think possibly to offer. And interestingly enough, if according to the information that I have, like whatever remaining Hermeticists that seem to still exist, I mean, they just do the Jesus prayer now. Like that's the thing that maybe they think that that's all that's really left of what Hermeticism. And so they get together and they do the Jesus prayer and they're not initiating anybody else. It's like the doors
closed. Oh yeah.
There's no one else coming in. They're just going to die with whatever it is that they have.
Let me initiate you. I will be your master. Yeah. My trajectory is kind of very similar to yours. And I got to the point, I was like, no, how about I just bloom where I was planted? I'll try that. Right. Which, I mean, it's good. And it, you know, sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's not so good. But, and this is what drew me towards sociology, you know, because I saw in sociology, you know, this very, very much an ecumenical thing, right? Because there were Russians who were doing it and attracted to it, Vladimir Soloviev, Bulgakov, Florensky, Berdyaev. But there were also Protestants who kind of started it off in modern times. Jakob Burma, the Philadelphian Society, Thomas and Henry Vaughan, for sure. And then a little bit later, it hit the West, in the Catholic West, with Louis Boyer and Thomas Merton and people like this, right? So to me, it seemed the appeal with that was not that it was fit material for some kind of esoteric construct, but that it was just very simple in having the idea that if we're in a right relationship with God and creation, we're in a right relationship. Mm-hmm. That's what sociology is, that's enough for me. I don't need all these elaborate systems and explanations and wheels within wheels to figure it out.
I was just going to say, it was interesting that you mentioned the ecumenical piece, because Bulgakov was particularly committed to those kind of ecumenical efforts. When he was in England, he tried to bring his Anglican community that he was associated with in communion with the Orthodox Church. So he was deeply committed to that kind of vision.
So I think, to me, the whole, you could say that, let's say the hyper-ecumenical part, I do see how it is related to sociology. And that's one of the reasons why maybe I am careful about. So I tend to, if you listen to my talks, you'll notice I talk about the idea of the secret feminine, for example. Mm-hmm. Like I'm afraid of the explicitation of the mystery, let's say, of the feminine in the Christian story. I'm very scared of that. And I feel like those that have gone too far in that, they tend to fall into a strange relativization again of forms. And so
and they get flaky. right?
And they they're flaky in this, but they move. Like, it's like, I'll give you an example, very practical example. My own brother went to a Trappist monastery to search for his own vocation, spent a month there and met with all these Thomas Merton monks. And he said every single day he would speak to the supervisor there, who would come to talk to him, the spiritual advisor. And all the guy would do was talk about Buddhism.
Really?
That's all he would talk about. My own brother was like, well, what about Jesus? He's like, yeah, of course. He'd talk about Jesus for about 2 minutes and then he'd go right back to Buddhism. And it's like, there's something about that. When I notice, like, I've seen with a lot of the non-dualists, and I'm seeing that with like someone that I admire David Bentley Hart very much so, but I'm seeing some of that even in, sometimes I see him almost have a disdain for Christianity and disdain for orthodoxy. Sometimes when he's speaking, it's like, it's trite, you know, let's talk about Shankara and let's talk about all these other non-dual systems. And I'm like, I don't know how helpful this is, especially in a public discussion.
And that's what bothers me about perennialism and those kinds of traditionalisms, which is, well, if everybody's right, what am I doing this for? Why am I looking, you know, but because I don't buy it. Right. Because I figured for me, it's like, well, the incarnation, the crucifixion and the resurrection. That's what I need right there. Mm. And I get it. Right. And I'm sticking with that guy. Right. Mm. That's the God I'm going to stick with. You know what I mean?
No, because, I of course totally agree with you.
Yeah.
No. And I think objectively it's the story of Christ is unsurmounted. Like there's nothing that beats that story. So it's like, it's.
Well, I would say that even the possibility of perennialism being a view that people hold is only because of Christ. I don't think that there's no way in a pre-Christian era you could have that as a thing that anyone would think.
Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of paganism is actually pretty relativistic in that sense. You know, so the ancient pagans usually had like in the back of their mind a map, a cosmic map, and then they would map on to the different cultures that they would encounter. And so you can read in ancient Greek and Roman texts, like, you know, oh, they worship this god. It would map on their gods to the other gods.
Map the Roman gods onto the German gods and so on. Yeah.
And you see the same, like, I think Indian systems like Advaita, they tend to be quite relativistic in terms of understanding that this kind of manifests itself everywhere. Like the pattern that they believe in is basically in every culture.
Yeah. On the other hand, I think it is, I mean, not for everybody. I mean, it's not everybody's thing, but the study of comparative religion and what's beautiful in other religions is really a worthwhile activity, right? Which is what, I don't know about you, but that's basically what I was doing from the age of 18 till about 28 or so, you know, so I was just checking it out. I mean, I, like you, I never didn't feel like I was a Christian, you know, never, not ever, you know?
Yeah, I tend to really see now, like my approach to comparative religion is really I guess I like what Nate was saying, it really is Christ-centered. That is, I tend to see everything through the lens of the incarnation. Mm-hmm. And then I'm able to look at other traditions without feeling either overwhelmed or threatened or whatever. Yeah. I just see it as glimmers and manifestations of the incarnational principle. And so in that sense, I never feel like I'm in danger of being overwhelmed by all these other traditions. And I also, like, I would never participate in other religious rituals. You know, I only participate in the Christian tradition, but I can read a Sufi poem and find it beautiful and insightful and extremely connected to something which I see in the Church Fathers as well.
Right. And it's interesting that, you know, in Tomberg, two things he says on this topic. He says, you know, while who came before me were beggars and thieves, right? Meaning all the religions that came before were beggars and thieves. And the other thing is, behold, I make all things new. So how those different systems, we could say, and this is what I think Tomberg's trying to do in his book. And this is what actually Hans von Balthasar said about Soloviev, is that that Soloviev took all these, you know, Gnostic systems and other things, and he ran them through Christ through a purifying stream, right? Mm. And I think that's part of what Tomberg's project is in that book, is to clean it up, you know?
Yeah, which and is also what Christians to, and always also, do, right? Christians did that with Plato, did it with Plotinus.
And he's giving people of that esoteric bent a way back in. I remember when I read the book, I said, wow, in my father's house, there are many mansions. Because what my problem was before that is I thought I had a very limited perception and understanding of what Christianity is. And I read that book. I said, wow, maybe I didn't give this thing enough credit, the Catholic Church. Maybe I didn't give it enough credit. Maybe I didn't. I was too busy seeing the version I got in the suburbs of Detroit at a second-rate Catholic school and not what's really there.
Yeah. But that's actually one of my arguments for Christianity really has been its integrative possibility. Because one of the things that I see also, and that's what I call, I don't know how to call it, like the esoteric split that happened, you know, at the Renaissance or after a bit after the Renaissance, is that you can see how things, how these elaborate and very intellectual systems kind of move up. And then you can notice religion becoming more and more sentimental and moralistic and less and less understood, you could say. And so, but I think that what Christianity ultimately offers is a way, it should be a way all the way through. So it's like when you stand in a church and you have this painted system of images, right? Yeah. It's connected to a simple person could go in there and be completely touched and impressed. But then, you know, a metaphysician will walk in and see the map of the universe in the church. So I think that that's one of the reasons why I tend to stay within, let's say, the more traditional. Just talk about the church fathers as much as possible. Or saying, I mean, I would choose the church fathers, right? It's like it's always the same. St. Ephraim, St. Gregory, St. Maximus. So, you know, and they seem to have had all those intuitions that are in the best of the esoteric systems, let's say.
Well, and that's what I think we were talking earlier about why people feel sometimes that the salt has lost its savor. And this is my own experience growing up. You know, I was kind of just naturally interested in mysticism. I mean, I went to Catholic school and, you know, I wanted to know this person talked to Jesus or the Virgin Mary. What'd they say? What was it like? How does that happen? And nobody wanted to tell me, right? You know, cause, and I think, so what I got instead was, you know, the catechism or kind of a dry intellectual delivery. We had the Baltimore Catechism. It was, I think that's turned more people off the Catholic Church than the sex scandal. But, and so it was for me, certainly, I mean, for a lot of people, it was an unincarnated experience of Christianity, which is ironic, right? And how do you return to that? And I actually, most of my life has been trying to find a way back into that incarnated experience of Christianity.
Mm. You know? Yeah. And I mean, I see all your daily practices of being a farmer and doing that. I can see when I kind of follow you and see what you're doing, I can notice that you're really trying to find that lived, let's say, incarnational principle.
Yeah. So, I don't want to read about it. You know what I mean? Well, yeah, you know, because I think what happened after that split you talked about at the Renaissance or the Reformation is, at least in the West, not only did religion become more and more sentimental, but the other half of it is became aridly intellectual.
Yeah.
You know, parts of it. I mean, that's the entire thing, right? And it was, in fact, I was reading in Florensky, he was talking about the Russian tradition, which is what I love about it, is it's both intellectual and anti-rational at the same time. You know, it's very intuitive or mystical while it's being intellectual, which is, you know, you see that probably in Solovyov more than in anybody, you know, who is the model for both Ivan and Aloysia in the Brothers Karamazov.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah. That's it. Actually, it's in a book written by his nephew because Dostoevsky was good friends with Solovyov.
Okay. Yeah.
And he based those two brothers on his two sides. His
That's hilarious.
His coldly intellectual side and his deeply intuitive and warm side.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. So what do you think about, like, let's say the basic perception that I have, which is, let me give you a very practical example about what I'm talking about. And so, you know, especially this is interesting because the Georgia Guidestones were destroyed, right? Just a few weeks ago or whatever, last week. And so, you know, according to the legend, the person who had it built was named Christian R.C. And
yeah,
so,
I saw that.
So you could say, in a way, it doesn't matter, like whether or not this is related to any group that is actually considering themselves Rosicrucian. There is something about the branding. There's something about the fact that normal Christians wouldn't refer to the Rosicrucians. But right now, something like weird, anti-human, esoteric, like kind of occultist type thinking will attribute themselves to the Rosicrucians.
Uh-huh.
We could say like it's too bad or whatever, but there's something about that which I think is important to understand in terms of this split that I talk about.
Absolutely.
Where, and the, let's say, the accumulation of this esoteric tendency into, let's say, Freemasonry groups or whatever, right. Like trying to capture. And Blavatsky was also kind of trying to pull whatever she could from all that stuff. So this is, I think, so it's like, although I can, for example, in someone like Robert Flood, I can see, let's say, the power and the good intentions that are there and this desire to keep something magical and wonderful about Christianity. It's like, by the time you get to Crowley, it's like,
oh, yeah.
And all these people are seeing themselves in line with that same mm-hmm. type of thinking. I'm like, something's off. Like something really went
off. Absolutely.
And I need to not be too associated with whatever that is.
No, you're right. And so my doctorate, I did my dissertation. One of the chapters is on, it's kind of, in fact, the title is The Rosicrucian Mysticism of Thomas and Henry Vaughan. Mm-hmm. Because they were part of that initial 17th century movement. But if you and the original documents of the Rosicrucians were written by a Lutheran pastor. And if you read them, they're as straightforward Christianity as you can get. You know, it's they were just interested in the rebuilding of society. And some people try to say that they wanted to rebuild society in the scientific way, which is not true at all. What's your name? Frances Yates wrote a book, The Rosicrucian Enlightenment. I think she totally misunderstood what was going on. It was actually, like I said earlier, a kind of a traditionalist movement that didn't want to lose that traditional Western Christian understanding of the relationship of the microcosm to the macrocosm, about God's presence in the world, about the presence of angels and demons in the world, right?
Yeah.
Is contributing to even weather patterns, right? Which was all thrown out the window with René Descartes. And they were, in fact, they would rip on Descartes in their books. They didn't like him at all.
Didn't Descartes write a public letter trying to be initiated into the Rosicrucians?
Yes, he did. They turned him down. Good choice. Yeah. I would have turned him down too. I'm not answering that call. Yeah. That's hilarious. But it's funny because you read that. And so when I think of Rosicrucianism, I automatically think of that stuff.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, when you read it, you can't see how anybody could interpret it otherwise. But then you look at the Crowley stuff and the Golden Dawn, and that came much later. And as we said earlier, these appropriations of the term. In fact, even the idea of the Rose Cross there, and I think it's a good argument that the Rose Cross comes from the coat of arms of Martin Luther, which had a cross and a rose on it,
yeah.
You know? So who could be, some people think the RC means Roman Catholic. You know, there was a lot of discussion in the 17th century about whether this is actually the Jesuits trying to get Protestants to come back into the fold.
Yeah, because, always the Jesuits.
You know,
it's always the Jesuits, right?
Well, they were smarter than everybody. So how does it get from there to what it became in the 19th century? It's just, or even the 18th century.
Yeah.
It's so strange.
But I think we really have to understand it as this deincarnation. It's like we often think of something which becomes decadent as always going too low, but it actually always starts with going too high. It's like there's pride. Pride is the first sin. And so there's something about trying, and you can see it like in the very rituals of the early occultists and, you know, the early magicians and the demonologists. There's something very powerful pride in that,
right.
In the very idea of, let's say, weaponizing or capturing these spiritual entities and inquiring from them or using them to manifest their will. It's like that is definitely something which I think represents that pride, which would even though maybe it, you all do it for the good reasons at the beginning, right? It's like, you know, we're going to do this to help the world. We're going to capture these demons in order to understand them and then exorcise them from society. It's like, that leads very quickly, in my opinion, to something.
Absolutely. I agree. I totally agree. And that's what I think, in fact, in my dissertation, the first chapter is on John Dee, who was doing that precisely and who got played like a game of Yahtzee by the spirits.
by these principalities.
The thing is, he was a good man, I think.
Yeah.
You know, he's a guy who loved his family, loved his country, was, you know, doing all the right stuff. But as you said, his problem was his pride. You know, I am the one who will bring this to the world. Yeah. And he thought that he was going to recover the language of Adam and that would heal all the divisions in Christendom. You know, wrong. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, the spirits talk him and his assistant to swapping their wives, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, you don't get any more mortal sin than that, right?
Yeah, it doesn't get better after that.
Let's just do them all. Repent. Yeah, let's just get all this.
It doesn't get better after that. It's like,
but I think, but on the other hand, you look at Henry Vaughan and his brother, and there's a, I mean, especially in Henry, there's such a beautiful practical spirituality in his poetry that's both connected to nature and to God and to scripture. I mean, it's, I remember when I so doing a dissertation, you have to read everything the person wrote. So I was reading all this guy wrote, and dawned on me, oh yeah, this is basically what I am. This is what I am. This is my spirituality right here, which is very simple. It's not complicated, and it's not occult in the least, but it's very mystical, I would say, in a practical mystical way.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. Just not, you know, not a hopefully not a prideful one, but you know, what's important? God, his creation, and community, right? The church, we call the community of the church. And that, I think, from, you know, if you focus on what's important, then you protect yourself, hopefully, from a little bit of evil.
Yeah, well, definitely. I think that that's also, so I don't know if you've noticed, like, there's an interesting moment right now. It's just interesting because it seems like something got broken, I guess, in the past 10 years. I don't know how to say it. Something broke. And all of a sudden, secular atheists and secular people are now able to perceive principalities, and they're able to understand at least what it is that we're even talking about when we use the word angel. So it's an interesting moment, but it's also in some ways a very dangerous moment. And that's something that I sometimes don't emphasize enough, especially with the psychedelics. A lot of people taking psychedelics and they indiscriminately encounter beings, and then they're all excited about whatever it is that they encounter. And so I don't know if you've noticed that it seems like we're at a moment where magic seems to be seeping back into the world, but it's not all positive. Like, it's a mix.
Which is weird because that's seeping in while at the same time where everything's becoming disenchanted through the internet, right?
Yeah.
So there's this weird polarity going on, right?
It's almost as if a natural movement of moving so far into darkness that all of a sudden, like, you know, these small lights start to be visible and people start to see. Also, because we're noticing, I think one of the things that's doing it is actually the internet, because the internet is based on attention, and it's actually bringing to the fore the function of attention in the way the world lays itself out. And so it's like, there's not much more, like, that's what magic is. Like, magic is about that. And so if you understand that, and now people have that experience where they're noticing how there's everything is vying for their attention, and that attention is actually creating bodies of interest and is actually kind of transforming reality. And because it's accelerated online, right? It's usually these cycles of interest are long, and they don't last like 2 days or 1 week, or it's sometimes one day, you know, this idea of something trending, you know. And so I think that there's something about that which is making people notice something like the vertical causality that Thomberg talks about. That is that there's a relationship between, that there's a relationship between like common attention and then things manifesting themselves, I'd say.
Yeah. Right. Egregore.
Yeah. That's what a lot of us are trying to talk about and try to help people differentiate the different. But I'm even as I'm doing that, I'm worried because like I meet people that are like all excited. They're like you talk about these angels, I want to meet them. It's like, what? No, that's not why we're doing this. Like, we're doing this so that people can see through, let's say, at least understand this hierarchy of principality so they can see incarnationally. But it's not about like having it try to have encounters with angels. It's usually not the good angels. They don't want to talk to you that way.
That's right. I always tell people way back in the day. My students would say, Mr. Martin, I'm going to use the Ouija board. I'm like, no. Why? Because it's like dialing seven numbers and saying, can I talk to Jesus? Yeah. And the demon says, he thinks it's Jesus.
That's right.
Jesus speaking. You know what I mean? You're asking for trouble because they're smarter than you. And they'll like with John Dee, they'll play you like a game of Yahtzee. Mess. You know what I mean? They'll just ridicule you. Thomberg actually talks about that, how they lead people along. Yeah, you're special. Come on. And we'll give you all this information, which is all just ends up being gobbledygook.
Right? Yeah. And you see it like if you've known, I usually see it a lot in the people that I around me that are interested in kind of new age stuff and get sucked into that. Then they all have their weird guardian angels and their weird guides and stuff. And it's usually never ends well. Like it just
never
just doesn't go well.
Never, ever.
Oh man. So Nate, so what is it that you wanted us to talk about besides the things you talked about already?
You guys seem to have no problem.
Are there things that you're curious about? Cause I also wanted this to be
out. There's one thing you said early on. It's interesting the way Tomberg actually approaches the subject of reincarnation. Cause he just says either you've experienced it or you haven't. And he doesn't argue.
You can't argue for it.
Right. Exactly. And he doesn't make any argument for it being a meaningful part of a spiritual system of any kind. It's just kind of like, and then he drops it after that. Yeah, so the way he presents it is weird. So I'm wondering what you thought of that. And then in letters, I don't know if you got into letter six yet, but this idea of evolution being like on the horizontal plane under the guise of the serpent. That was very interesting to me because I can remember when I was raised Pentecostal, and I can remember when I was going through my catechism, when I was converting to Catholicism, I still like had some misgivings about evolution. And I thought, and I made this argument to my priest about how you really can't, if evolution is absolutely true without any qualification, there's no resolution to the problem of evil possible because you can't really, there's no way of dealing with the physical evil.
Yeah.
So I thought the way that Tomberg talks about evolution as being this groping trial of the serpent offers a way to do that.
I tend to, like the way that I presented before and the way I present it now is that I think natural selection is a pattern in the world. It's a true pattern, and it's a pattern that can help you understand things. But I think the narrative evolution is just useless and not interesting, and it doesn't help you do anything. Like it always ends up having to be represented mythologically, despite the scientists pretending that it's not.
This is kind of what Tomberg says too, though, because he says it's a fact, right? So it's a fact on the horizontal plane. It's a fact, but it's a fact only on the horizontal plane, and that because it's on the horizontal plane, its origin is the serpent.
But you know, I think Tomberg was a man of his time, and that was the language that was the language of evolution was which was appropriated by Blavatsky, and the early Steiner also picked up on it, and they were speaking in these kinds of terms. Now it's spiritual evolution, right? Now my friend Guido Preparata, he's a blunt and funny guy, and he thinks Darwin's whole project was just a project to prove British imperialism. You know, it was social Darwin, you know, what we call social Darwinism now. Yeah, that's what it is. See, the survival of the fittest. The British are the fittest. End of story. Right. So I don't buy it. I mean, personally, I don't know what to think of the evolution narrative. I mean, I'm sure things do. I'm a farmer. I know how things work. But of course, we have a society that believes in evolution, but doesn't believe in gender. I can't figure it out. Well, you know,
it's also the thing, the whole evolution narrative is the most, it's just so hilarious because the evolution narrative ends up being teleological. I mean, they can't avoid it. Every time they try to make it non-teleological, they fail. And so it always ends up having to be teleological. And so then it becomes non-scientific immediately. It just becomes a kind of a mythological pattern. And it's like, well, if it's just a mythological story, my mythological story is much better. Like the creation narrative in Genesis accounts way in a better manner for the ontological hierarchy of your experience of the world than the way that evolution talks about reality. And you can see, like, I mean, when I talk to Brett Weinstein, it's always the same issue. And you see the same with all the evolutionary theorists. They're basically saying, what evolution really wants you to do is to basically kill and compete and take and just get your seed out there, get your genes to the next generation. But of course, we shouldn't do that.
Right.
It's like, okay, well, where do you get the we shouldn't do that from?
Yeah.
That's actually what interests me, because that's a lot closer to what I care about. And then maybe you can find that in the Genesis story, but the other, you can't find it anywhere else in your little pattern, like in your little worldview.
Well, you know who believes in the evolution story? The World Economic Forum. Yeah. And guess who's at the top of that food chain? But, you know, it's interesting because you think about, you mentioned Genesis. Genesis is the opposite of the evolution. It's the fall.
Yeah.
Right? It goes in the opposite direction.
Yeah. I mean, and you're right. But you can understand it's so much closer to even to the way that evolutionists think of their teleological project, because there is a hierarchy of being. If you read St. Ephrem, it's beautiful. Like St. Ephrem says things like the animals did not come into the garden, right? And so the animals would come to the foot of the garden, then Adam would come down the mountain and he would like encounter them. And that's when he named them and everything. So there's this sense in which like the type of ontological hierarchy that they tried to create in their evolutionary system, it's there in the more traditional narrative, and it actually accounts for morality and responsibility and all this stuff that we actually think even now, even all these weird environmentalists, like super environmentalists, they believe in what Genesis says. Like they believe that we're the gardeners and we should take care of creation and that we shouldn't abuse it. And it's like, if you're really like just an evolutionist, I don't know if you could really believe any of those things.
I agree. Well, that's what happened with, and I think that explains Tomberg's attraction for Teilhard de Chardin, right?
Yeah.
Because that's evolution taken into Catholic theology.
Yeah, I haven't gotten there. And so maybe I'll definitely have my beef with him when he gets to Teilhard de Chardin. I don't know yet.
Well, I don't know if you read Teilhard. I mean, he's a beautiful writer. He writes like a poet.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful writing. And he has a lot of brilliant insights, I think. The Complete Project. I don't have to agree with people about everything that they'd say.
Yeah, of course, you're right. You're totally
to
right.
Like them. I'm cool with the parts I like, you know? I don't have to be all in.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. That's how I approach pretty much everything. Like, I don't have to defend everything that this person that I, you know, slightly associated with says.
I don't agree with everything my wife says, you know? Well, what about some guy I never met, right? You're gonna tag me with everything he ever thought or believed.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Don't tell her that.
He says, don't tell her that. I'm sure she knows.
She knows.
She says.
Yeah, she knows.
And so, I mean, like for me, I think that the solution that I've been trying to propose has really been taking the traditional forms that are there, taking the liturgical life that has all the potential. Like you said, like even if it's lost, if it's lost its salt, it's like it's there. It just has to be kind of recaptured and relived. And so to me, that seems like the only really realistic solution. And in it.
Well, one of the things that Florensky mentioned in there, which kind of added savor to it, was those kinds of folk traditions.
Yeah.
You know, that. Are they really Christian? Are they kind of Christian? But yeah, let's keep those in there because those make Christianity a way of life and not something you do on Sunday, right? Mm. And try to think, you know, I say a couple of prayers during the day, but how do you incorporate that into a lived life, right?
Yeah, definitely. Because modern people tend to think more monastically. It's like they think that, you know, living a more kind of embodied Christian life would mean to just have, you know, do the hours or whatever, do more services. But I think you're right that there's an even more embodied way, which is if you think of the Middle Ages and they had all these associations and clubs and people would, you know, be in the association of this saint and they would have their costumes and they would have all this stuff and they would have, you know, like all these banners and processions and stuff. It's hard for us to even imagine it, but I know it's still with my friend Andrew Gould. I remember he said he went to this little village in Spain and he said it was just astounding. Like they had these 4-hour, 5-hour processions of their statue of the Mother of God, you know, all dressed up and everybody had these like particular costumes and they would just kind of walk around and he said it was so solemn and it lasted forever, but everybody was just completely enthralled by these processions. And so, it's just hard because we don't in North America, it always feels like always feels like we lost like so much of it that to bring it back is almost idiosyncratic.
Yeah.
I mean, and I say that for the Orthodox very much. It's like people become Orthodox and they think they'll immediately become Russian or it's like, that's not going to happen, right? You have to find some kind of discussion about how to embody folk traditions, right? So let's say for us on Theophany, like we'll still do like the traditional French Epiphany celebration, right? We have a cake and we bake a bean in it.
Yeah,
and
we do it too.
And we have like the king of the day and stuff. And so like, this is not Orthodox, but it's like, these are the traditions that we have.
But it's French Canadian, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely French Canadian, that's for sure.
Yeah, we do it
too. We need to like find ways to connect all this in a way that it's going to be messy and organic, but it was so already in the folk traditions.
Isn't that kind of
already
the norm for Orthodoxy, though? It's a kind of like morph itself somewhat to the culture that it's expressed in.
It should, hopefully. But well, the Greeks have a lot of, you know.
Yeah. The other thing that the bean cake and, you know, all that stuff. I also think that's a way to have children. This is a way to raise children in a lived experience of Christianity, you know, because they're not going to. We all remember being in church as little kids listening to a sermon. I mean, not listening to a sermon and wondering how long is this going to take, right? But those festivals of conviviality make it for children and for growing people too, a lived experience. And then when people have children, they want that. People hunger for that.
Yeah,
they want an experience of the world that is not only spiritually nourishing, but that nourishes their souls and the relationship with other people. Because you can do it by yourself, right? There's something different when you do it in a community.
Yeah.
Which is what a church is supposed to be.
And I think that's why, I mean, I've noticed a lot of these Orthodox churches take it seriously, is to realize how that coffee hour in terms of a modern church is absolutely essential. Like you really need to have 1 or 2 hours after liturgy or after a service for people to be together, because we're not in a village anymore. You don't just walk out and then go back to your house and then it's your neighbor that was there in church with you. Right. So we have to create these spaces where we can have, you know, a more informal communion, or else it's not going to gel.
Otherwise it's like punching a clock. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Going to liturgy, go communion, go back home.
Okay.
Bad coffee is important. Check.
But we really noticed, we've noticed that at least in my parish, because we are seeing our parish grow quite a bit in the last year. I think a lot of parishes are growing because of post-COVID people looking for meaning and stuff.
Yeah.
And we've noticed that that's been one of the keys, has been to have a place and a time afterwards for people to sit down and to connect. And so then it encourages them to call each other during the week and to connect in other informal ways. So. Yeah, so you're right. So we need these more embodied practices. Because liturgy is wonderful, but it's not. It has to kind of seep into all of reality. It can't just be.
It's got to be everywhere. Yeah. Mm.
So I mean, how does that play into? I know, Michael, you've expressed some disappointment with the way that the church handled COVID.
I have.
And how? And I mean, it seems to me that what you guys are talking about right now, and the way the church has kind of handled COVID.
I honestly think that COVID was a litmus test for a lot of churches. And I think that a lot of the churches that weren't attentive to what was happening and didn't take into account the primacy of communion, I think there a lot of them won't get over this.
I really
believe that they just won't survive. And I think the opposite is also true. The churches that a lot of them were cautious at the outset, started to realize that, okay, wait a minute, there's something else going on. And then started to emphasize communion over being strict on the rules and everything. I think those will thrive, and they have thrived.
Well, yeah. It was so profoundly discouraging to see so many, especially in the Catholic Church, when the Pope required all employees of the Vatican to have the vaccination. And then no, they backed off. They never apologize when they back off. It's like, oh yeah, well, we were, you know, it becomes they're slaves to policy. And if you probably saw too, there were many churches out across North America and in Australia, places who would have signs saying fully vaccinated parishioners may come to confession or to communion, right?
Can you imagine that? I don't know if you know what happened here in Quebec. It was crazy because So we had, the churches were closed for the longest time, right? And then finally they were open with limited people, whatever, blah, 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 and all this stuff.
Right.
But then came the moment when they were gonna impose the COVID vaccine passport on the churches. That was, I think, the litmus test. And those churches that tried to find solutions to that and not impose it, because you would have to have a parishioner standing at the door with their phone scanning people as they walked into the church. Can you imagine how crazy that is?
The doors, right? Let us see it. That's what that was for, right? When they say the doors, it was to keep the spies out. Look at the spies.
Yeah, exactly.
So they'll come in here and kill us after we say the creed.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that I've seen some churches did crazy stuff. It was minus 30, right? It was in December, in January. Yeah. And so some churches just had services outside, you know, people found ways to get around it or whatever. But I think the churches that applied it That is not a lot of hope for those guys. I'm sorry to say. Wow. I mean, maybe they'll survive, like, but I don't think, I think it's going to be a serious, they're going to have to do it with a lot of like repentance and return to, and deliberate desire to re-enter communion, because.
Yeah. Well, and I think we'll also see a kind of Church of the Catacombs.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, under kind of a guerrilla church or underground church or something, you know?
Yeah. And people have to learn to do, like, we started to learn to do the reader services, you know, because it's like, if we depend on the clergy completely, then we're going to be in trouble. It's
that was up. I don't know how.
Well, you brought up Soloviev several times, Michael, and I can't help but think of Tale of the Antichrist. It's the majority of the church goes along.
Yeah, with the Antichrist.
With the Antichrist, yeah. in that story. It's just like the three figures that he has representing the, you know, the Protestant, the Catholic, and the Orthodox tradition. They're the ones with the courage to stand up. But the vast majority of the clergy in all three go along.
Yep, they join the Antichrist.
So. Well, it's not hard to see it now. Like, there's something wonderful about the moment right now, which is that there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of, let's say, apocalyptic thinking that I didn't totally understand, let's say, 20 years ago. And I'm not saying that this is it, like this is the end of the world or whatever. Right. But I think that there's a lot of structure that I can now see. And not only do I understand them, but I can see them burgeoning. I can kind of see them popping up in the world. And it's like, okay, I understand what this is talking about.
Well, it's a revelation, right?
Yeah,
in that sense. It's tearing the veil open. Yeah. So you can see it. What's going
and,
on?
I mean, also, I like the idea of Antichrist itself, like the idea of something which is a parasite on Christian morality, but manifests itself. So it's like, right, the idea, for example, that we saw, like the weaponizing of compassion that we saw during the COVID time, it's like that was like a weird parasite on Christianity. Yeah, so you can kind of see, it's like, okay, I can kind of, I mean, I'm not saying this is Antichrist, but I can kind of see the pattern of Antichrist, how it can manifest itself and how it can also delude people, how it can trick people into believing this is true Christianity.
And tricking is the right word, right?
Yeah. And you can see, like, it's, you can see, like, with even with like the, who would have thought that, so for example, like, it's like in the abortion debate, I'm sorry to become political here, but like, who would have thought that there would be a coming moment when someone would be able to say out loud publicly, a Christian should be pro-abortion. It is the Christian position to have. Like, this is the compassionate Christian position to have, to be pro-abortion. It's like, and you see now people take that position all the time. It's like, really? It's like, who would have thought? But then you can see it. It's a weaponizing of compassion and a weaponizing of the idea that we're in the image of God. Like, all of these Christian ideas are being twisted and contorted to bring about these strange positions.
Yeah, that's all. Yeah. Okay, guys, I'm depressed. No, that's right.
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
But Michael, I'm not depressed. I'm a 50-50 all the time. Like, this is why I think how I survive. Like, I'm 50-50 all the time because on the one hand, I can kind of see, all of a sudden I see these patterns that are straight up from the Book of Revelation kind of come towards me. And at the same time, I'm also seeing the candle like being lit. I can see like the next, I don't know what to say. Like, I can get a glimmer of the resurrection. This maybe is another way to say it. I can see it. Like, I can actually see it, and I can notice, you know, I had this talk with someone like Ian McGilchrist that I think I put up today. Yeah, I had a talk with Don Hoffman, all these like cognitive science type people that are total secularists, or even my discussion with John Vervaeke. It's like John Vervaeke and them were using the word angel and demon as if this was a totally normal technical word to use to talk about transpersonal beings. And I was like, I can't believe that we've reached this point where a scientist would use that word and not flinch or not feel embarrassed at all about using it. So I think we're going to be surprised. Like, there's going to be some wonderful surprises and some dark surprises at the same time.
Well, I think so too. And that's, you know, and I kind of saw it coming and wrote about it, you know, because I think, you know, like you're saying, that we had the rise of the technocracy or the archons, if you want to call them that.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is also, you know, the real possibility to live the kingdom, you know, that the kingdom of heaven is within you, you know. So there's a capacity to realize that. And I think, and if you go back to the early Christians, there were parallel societies there too, parallel polices, right? There was the power structure and there was the kingdom. And I don't think we've had enough awareness of the kingdom for the past couple of few generations, you know, and I think part of it, I think, happened if you read World War II or post-World War II literature, when all the intellectuals were like, what the heck just
happened?
You know what I mean? They're soul searching. And I think that really destroyed a lot of people as far as religion goes, not just Christianity, you know, that the Holocaust could happen and you could have that much evil and God didn't intervene, right? And I think we have it at a different manifestation of that kind of evil right now. But maybe in a way, this is our opportunity to not despair as happened to those people in the 1940s and 50s, right? Yeah. Where they despaired. And it's really easy to despair.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, right now. From listening to my wife, I would say that like the Jewish experience in that post-Holocaust is almost like the opposite, though. Like there was a lot of Jews who weren't really even religious. Like they returned to Judaism, not even out of any real religious commitment, but just out of the idea that there should be more Jews in the world. Because like both her parents like were basically atheists, but they made sure that their children were raised with the knowledge of their faith and practiced anyway. So
yeah, I mean, I think for sure like the rise of the Hasidim is based like in part in like the World War II and like the return of kind of Orthodox Judaism or the strength of Orthodox Judaism does seem to be. But I think it's not like I think what it's the two extremes, you could say, because also. Mm-hmm. I mean, the secular Jew is extremely powerful in the world right now as well. Like you have a lot of that very strong. So I think we're probably going to see something similar in the Christian church. We're going to see a kind of remnant which will consolidate and become, you know, deliberate and authentic. And at the same time, we're going to see the world in general become more and more anti-Christian and secular. So
right. I think so.
I mean, especially as the churches, like here in Quebec, like the churches are at some point they're going to start to demolish the churches. Like they have to because they're trying to send these things out. They're trying to sell them, but it's like all these old buildings no one wants to keep up. And so at some point we're going to start to see bulldozers like go into these things. Mm-hmm. It's going to be inevitable. We see it in Europe happening now all the time. Mm-hmm. And so I think that'll be important. Like I think it's probably good that happens because it's going to help people see what's going on in ways that might both increase the secularism, but also shock some people into thinking, okay, so what is it then? It's like, is it more shopping malls? Is that what we really need? Or you know, is it a taller cell towers? Is that going to be like our, is that going to be our holy place? Is it going to be really, really tall cell towers? Sorry, Michael. I feel like I'm really not.
Oh, no, you're not bumming me out. No, no, I agree. And you know, I'm just, you know, I mean, in fact, you know, my gosh, my whole project is pretty, it's a pretty hopeful project, right? But but knowing you're up against this kind of darkness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what surprised me over the last couple of years is how effective the mass formation and propaganda project of the bad guys has been. I mean, you got to tip your hat. It was well orchestrated.
Yep.
That you could, but.
It's amazing. Like here in Canada, it's amazing. Like it's amazing. Yeah. I mean, Justin, you know, is just obviously like a empty like puppet.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. Like it just doesn't matter. It all works. Like it all.
The whole world is like that right now. The whole West.
Well, it's amazing how many sophisticated people show for it. I mean, just fall for it, though. I mean, it's really mind-boggling. Yeah. It kind of proves Alul's idea that elites are more prone to propaganda.
Oh yeah, it's, well, no, propaganda is never aimed at, you know, people with a high school education. They always aim propaganda at the middle managers, the teachers, professors, and doctors, and people like that who think they're smart. You're smart because you believe, yes, I'm smart, and I'm doing this to help others.
So you're saying it's designed specifically for dumb, smart people?
Yes.
The midwits. It's the midwits. They're the problem. They're always the problem. The midwits.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, it was really great getting to listen to you guys talk. I'm glad I brought you
to
together.
Have this conversation.
Yeah. So you got me to be quiet for the most part, which is not an easy task.
It was our plan. We talked ahead of time.
Yeah. Well, good. Excellent collusion then.
Oh, well, thanks for the conversation. This was
yeah. Great. Thanks for joining me today. I really appreciate the gift of your time. Both of you.
All right.
Appreciate this. I'll let you know when I get it posted.
All right.
All right. Great. Wonderful.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Symbolic World. The Symbolic World is based on a series of videos that you can find on my YouTube channel, Jonathan Peugeot's YouTube channel. You can also get involved. There is a Facebook group that has started by fans of the podcast called The Symbolic World Within the Zombie Invasion. I will put a link to that in the show description. And so it is a discussion of all things symbolism that it's quite interesting. I'd like to drop in there and also leave some of my comments as well. You can always help the podcast by, of course, leaving a review on iTunes. Everybody knows that's the best way to get the podcast out there, to get it heard. And if you want to get involved, you can also support the podcast financially going to www.thesymbolicworld.com/support or else on Patreon, the Peugeot videos as well, and on Subscribestar. All those links you can find on my website or in the show description. So thank you, and I will see you soon.